government need to be building houses. They need to be encouraging private investors and developers to be building more houses to make the process quicker and easier. I've been really hesitant about borrowing money off people that I didn't know. I've seen a lot of people do it badly, all over social media, and you're thinking they're dog's bollocks, and then all of a sudden they're gone and you never hear from them again. So, and I say this at our event quite often, I can get any speaker up here for 45 minutes and you will leave here thinking you've got to do what they do. They've made the money out of the property. They just can't be bothered with the hassle anymore. They don't want to invest in redecorating it or recarpeting it or even giving it a lick of paint. So from our point of view, we'll come in and we'll factor that cost in and we'll do that work.
On today's episode of The Engaging Marketeer, I am joined by Kieran Toner of Kiba Property. Kieran is a property investor, property mentor, property trainer, and runs property networking events. I think it's fair to say you like a bit of property.
Yes, I do.
Yes. So what got you started in property in the first place?
Believe it or not.
I don't.
No. I spent my 20s doing what I love, snowboarding, windsurfing, teaching around the world, traveling. I moved back to the UK, expecting a mundane office life going forwards.
That's what you were looking forward to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I live in Chester, so obviously did a little stint at MBNA, which was suicidal.
Who hasn't? Who's been from Chester?
I know. And then I ended up landscaping for a friend of mine. So I had a landscaping business for a couple of years, running into the credit crunch. We wrapped that up for various reasons. And I was looking at what to do next. And I randomly picked up a book called The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss, which you may or may not have heard of.
I have heard of it.
And that's the first thing I'd read for 10 years. And it just changed my thinking of different ways of making a living. I'd always had this initial thought of, right, you've got to go to work and you've got to exchange your time for money for it to get paid. That flipped my thinking. And then from that, I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And then another light bulb went, I was like, you don't know what you don't know. So I went out looking, I had a little bit of capital saved up, went out looking for an investment property. The plan was to buy something, do it myself, take a few months. I've got something for a pension.
So at this point, you hadn't had any property training?
No.
You'd read the books, you got the money, and you thought, I'm going to go.
I've read a couple of books, been doing a little bit of research online. Started viewing a lot of property and bought this first one. It was a little 65 grand ex-council house over in Birkenhead. And like I said, the plan was just do some work myself and put off looking for the career.
What year was that?
That was 2010.
2010, 65 grand. That's a fairly big house then.
It's a 3-bed, mid-terrace.
I was going to say, because Leanne bought some about 4 years ago and they were about 50K, sub 50K.
You can probably still buy for that in Birkenhead and some places, yeah.
So you don't get a lot of capital
not a huge,
appreciation?
No, that one's probably worth, I don't know, 110, 120 on a good day, maybe now. So, but the rental income's strong. So yeah, that was it. I was looking for something that hasn't been a huge amount of growth, but that wasn't really why I was buying them. So I was just looking for something that would, because I haven't got a traditional pension, I've never really been in a traditional workplace. So I was looking for something that would just fill a gap, give me something for the future, put a little bit of income in my pocket, and then worry about what to do next. And then I got offered another one and managed to stretch.
Did you buy that first one cash?
No, put deposit down. So I had a little bit left over, managed to stretch to another one, and then start to see a couple of rental incomes dropping into the accounts every month. And I started going to some property networking events. I wasn't a networker by any stretch of the imagination, especially not in a property space. And then from that, I was really skeptical. I know you work in the property space quite a lot. I was a person sat at the back with their arms folded and you're just trying to sell something.
Thinking, I don't need this.
Yeah.
I've got houses already. I don't need this.
Not even that. It was more of a car. It's a con. What are you selling me?
Yeah. Where's the catch?
Where's the catch? What's the catch? And then after a little while, I got over myself and kind of changed my approach. I was like, well, you must know something I don't if you've been able to make a living out of this, because I'd run out of money. So I went out and went out actively looking for some mentorship and some guidance to learn what could be done or how to buy. So at that point, those two had been bought straight off the open market through estate agents, Rightmove, essentially. So I went looking for some mentorship, and then it was, okay, well, if I can do stuff direct to vendor, we can buy below market value.
So did you do direct to vendor and below market value?
Yeah.
Because we dabbled with that a few years ago through Glenn Armstrong.
Yeah.
and it was horrible. The conversations that you have were horrible. We quickly realized it was not what we wanted to be doing.
See, I had a different experience. I had a very positive experience that the people I spoke to were actively looking for help.
Wow.
Not everybody sells for the most amount of money.
Yeah.
A lot of people sell for different reasons, different motivations. And I always went in the approach with, look, the first opening line was, if you want more money, put it on the open market. Yeah, that's the best way to get the most if you want from your house. If you want to sell quickly, you want to sell securely, we're looking at these sort of prices. If you're willing to be a bit more flexible in terms in the middle, then we can do something creative. So we did a lot of lease option stuff at that time as well, where you're locking your price in now, we take over the debt, we'll pay, buy the property when it becomes financially viable, shall we say.
And the idea with the lease options and the direct to vendor and below market value, that came from property training, or did you just do a seminar first?
I heard a little bit at the sort of the networking events I started to go to. And then it was the mentorship that sort of opened up how to do it and how to structure it and how to do it ethically as well and help people. I'm a big believer that, you know, it's only a good deal if it helps the person's situation out.
Yeah, because there's a lot of people out there that wouldn't think like that.
No. Definitely not.
Definitely not. We probably know some of them.
I'm sure we do.
But we won't mention that now. So for anyone listening that doesn't know what below market value is and how it works, what is the process you go through?
Okay, so we would put out marketing campaigns through various different media, promoting the fact that we'll buy your house fast.
So that's these leaflets you get through the door that says, we buy houses for cash, that kind of thing.
We buy fast, sell your property fast. Yeah. If you search sell your house fast on the internet, thousands of websites will pop up.
Yep, we've probably built some of them.
I'm sure you have. It's essentially similar to we buy any car.
Yeah.
Right? You know you're not getting the best price, but you're getting a secure sale.
So in fact, we built we buy any portfolio recently.
I saw.
Yes. Yes.
Not my website, though. Is it?
No.
So we put out different marketing channels, and then it'd be more motivated sellers approaching us, or people that struggled to sell or had sales fall through, so their motivation is starting to change.
So this is homeowners.
This is homeowners just targeting the residential market.
Need to sell their homes fast, and they've had either bad experiences already, or something's collapsed,
or they're behind,
they can't sell it.
Yeah, or they're starting to get behind on the mortgage payments.
Right,
they can't afford them on a monthly basis. Debt's racking up. Various different reasons: divorce, split up with the partners, bereavement. Or they've inherited a property at the end of the country. We've done a few deals like that where they just. It's not an asset. It's a liability. It's a problem. It's a headache. And they just want it solved and taken off their plate, basically. So various different marketing channels. And then we'd sit down, go and view the property. And the approach I always take and tell people I mentor and stuff is, it's not really about the property. It's about the situation that person's in and what they're looking to achieve. So, you know, if you're going to sit in a 3-bed terraced house, unless it's blatantly obvious, it's going to be reasonably sound. You know roughly how big it is. You know it's got 3 bedrooms. There'll be a kitchen in the back, a bathroom upstairs. So the house isn't really a surprise. It's, okay, the deal's structured by solving their problem, working out what it is they really want, which probably isn't what they tell you first off. Digging a little bit deeper, finding out what their real motivation is, and then seeing if we can structure something that not only works for us, but solves, importantly, their problem as well.
Mm. And how did you find negotiating with people like that and vendors who want to sell their homes? Because if it's their home, it's not just an asset to them, it's where they live. And they're going to be quite emotionally connected with it, I imagine, in a lot of cases.
You'd think, wouldn't you?
Yeah, not the case.
Not really. I think if someone's phoning in response to an advert or a leaflet they've got through the door, or they've gone onto your website and they found you, they've already made a decision that selling's maybe the best course. And then they're trying to work out, well, what's the best way to do it? Do I put it on Rightmove? It sits there for months. Bear in mind, this was 2010. Stuff wasn't selling.
Oh, yes, the post, yeah.
Yeah, we were still kind
the of recession.
Middle of the credit crunch or coming out of the credit crunch. So stuff really wasn't selling on the open market. It'd sit there for months. That probably didn't solve their problem. It only made things worse. Do they want the neighbours knowing they've been forced to sell up for some other reason? Do they want people traipsing through the home? More often than not, they just want someone to come in and go, well, yes, I know you, I could get this for it, but if you can give me this and we can get it done in 4 to 6 weeks, I'd be really happy. That would solve my problem. When I was first sort of introduced to the concept, I was like, why would anyone sell the house cheap? Why would they? It's like the biggest asset most people ever own. But it's only an asset if you want it and it works for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
As soon as you can't afford to pay for it, or there's another party that you're arguing over it, or you've it's the other end of the country and you're just paying out on bills and maintenance, it becomes a liability. And that's kind of what we do in property. It's just working out how do we solve that problem for those people.
And where was it that you got the concept of the below market value? What training course was it that you went on?
So I actually read Rob Moore's book, first ever book. I think we're going back to 20
was that
books on it.
Life Leverage?
No, we're going back to 44 ways to make cash in a property market crash, I think, in 2010. Okay. And that would have been, that was kind of the concept. Okay, there's the way to go out and approach this, and it's not really about the property. It's about the right, you'll buy any property at the right price. Training wise, I've been to a couple of their early events. I've done some stuff with Progressive, but it didn't really kind of gel with me at the time. I'm not one of these people that likes to be sold to in a room. I sat down on my sofa at home and I was looking at the different sort of entities online that were offering training and education at the time. And I went and worked with a guy called Hanif Khan and Parmdeep Fadesha. And they ran at the time, it was called the Tycoon Mastermind Alliance, which is like a yearly mentorship program.
That's three good words put together there, yeah. Isn't it? Tycoon Mastermind yeah. Alliance.
But it was, again, it was from a marketing point of view, it was their video testimonials, even back in 2010, of people that actually implemented what they talked about. That's kind of sold me, not necessarily their website or their pitch.
Yeah.
It was a testimony of other people that had been through the program the year before and the year before that. And when I actually approached them, I phoned up and said, look, I've been looking online. I quite like what you're offering. How do I get involved? And so we're having a barbecue in a couple of weeks. Why don't you come down to Leicester, Food's on Us, see if you like us, and we'll talk after that. So it was no hard sell at all. It was good.
No.
Yeah.
That's an unusual way of doing it.
I don't think they do that anymore. but yeah, I quite like that. And yeah, I learned a lot from that over the next 12 months or so.
Shows the importance of testimonials.
Definitely.
Because a lot of businesses don't do it. They don't even see why they should do it or think my clients aren't going to want to do it. So they don't ask.
It made it really real. Because, you know, they weren't people in suited and booted driving around in sports cars saying I've made my fortune in property. It was single mums. It was families looking to get ahead. It was normal people that had kind of got a little bit of knowledge. You don't know what you don't know. Taken it and applied it and made a significant difference, I'd say, over 12 months.
So once you did that then, how many times did you go through the process of the below market value properties to buy?
I don't think I've paid market value for anything since.
just generally, including in shops, anyway. Just don't pay whatever the price
definitely
is.
Not for houses.
I want a discount, whatever it is.
We bought 8 in the next 12 months.
8 in 12 months?
Yeah. Which was kind of enough to hit my goal of where I wanted to be as a young single man, not having to go and find a job after that. Mm. Obviously, we viewed plenty more houses. We had plenty of conversations with other people where we didn't get to a point where it worked for us and worked for them. And that's the kind of, it's that process of going through, you know, doing the marketing, doing the viewings, having the conversations, doing the negotiation, if you can or if you can't, make it work.
And in terms of the funding for those, how did you get the funding for the first one? And presumably each one then funded the next as well?
Yeah, so the initial couple I did, we could then, after a period of time, refinance and pull some money back out. And if you go, there was a product called Mortgage Express back in the late 2000s.
I am familiar with them.
They had a same-day remortgage product. So
property trainers speak very highly of the days of Mortgage Express.
Yeah, so we were just at the back end of that. So basically, the way that worked, essentially, if you could buy a property for... So you had to put down a 25% deposit. So let's say, keep it simple, your property's worth 100 grand. If you could agree to buy it for 75, you could buy it at 75, get it revalued the same day, and effectively you haven't got to... It's a paper exercise. You don't have to actually physically put the money down. So we were kind of coming to the back end of that. And there's ways of structuring it with a couple of different solicitors before they kind of close those loopholes. So we used a little bit of that as well, which was nice. But yes.
Where, of course, below market value isn't your only property strategy
now. No. So at that point, I kind of hit this goal of what I needed from an income point of view from the single let portfolio. These are all single lets at this point.
Can I ask what the income was, by the way, from the single let portfolio?
My goal was 3 grand a month. Net, pre-tax, which we did with 9 properties. It took me to get to that. So about £300 a property a month. After that, we got into HMOs, so houses of multiple occupation. That's professional house shares where people are renting a room rather than our house. They pay a fixed amount. We pay all the bills and utilities. They share kitchens and bathrooms. And we got into that initially through a sort of rent-to-rent approach, or where we would go and lease stuff off landlords, offer them a guaranteed rent. They get a fixed amount. Again, keep numbers simple. They get £1,000 a month, whether the property's empty or not, regardless of us. Let's say bills are £500. We might rent that for two and a half grand and make a margin in the middle. That's how we moved into the HMO market initially, and that was supposed to be an initial stopgap to boost the cash flow and keep buying, but it became a bit more of a lifestyle business where there's decent cash flow kicking in quite easily and quite quickly.
Because presumably there's a lot of landlords with properties that have had bad experiences with tenants, not paying, trashing it, not being able to rent it out.
Yeah.
And you coming in and offering them £1,000 a month, say, guaranteed.
Yeah.
Whether it was empty or not, and that you'll look after the property.
Yeah.
You're the one that's going to do all the maintenance on the property.
Yeah, we take the risk in the middle.
Yeah. There's no estate agents.
No.
Because nobody likes those bastards.
Yeah.
Taking their 15% people, which means you can get a lot more for the property by doing it that way.
Yeah.
And the landlord's happy, they're happy, you're happy, everybody wins.
Yeah, we've got, in this arrangement, and we've got a vested interest to make sure the property's looked after, it's kept nice, it's redecorated. We put the right tenants in, because no one wants a tenant that's not paying. And we get rewarded for making that margin in the middle. If you compare that to giving your property to a normal HMO letting agents, then this is nothing against them, but... Everyone starts off going, "Oh, we're going to focus on HMOs, and we'll fill that gap in the market where the landlords don't get looked after." And that's great if you've got one or two properties you're managing. But as soon as your portfolio grows with different landlords and different properties, and you get a tenant inquiry comes in for a room, you don't care whether it's that initial room they inquired about or whether they take one of the different properties that belongs to somebody else. So you can't scale a HMO business and keep the occupancy up to the levels it is if you manage it yourselves, or you operate a smaller sort of more niche rent-to-rent business. Does that make sense?
I think so.
I haven't explained that very well. Then, no. What I was trying to explain is, as a HMO portfolio grows, so we're at the point now where we've got all our HMOs are kind of bunched together. So if someone inquires to me about one of our HMO rooms and I've got another room available in another house, and it's two streets away, I will show them both rooms. Yeah, because it doesn't bother me which one they take as long as I fill one of them.
Yeah.
Now, if you imagine a letting agent's got 50 different properties with 40 different landlords, again, they'll take an inquiry and go, well, I've got this room, but I've also got this, 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 and this that might belong to some other landlord. Mm. So it's really hard for them to keep the occupancy high for every landlord they manage for.
Do estate agents typically get involved with HMOs themselves now?
Some do. Some focus on it. Some specialise in it. More so in the sort of student sector, because you're lining up tenants 9-10 months in advance for the following year, and managing that turnover in the summer. And for that reason, I just stated, it's difficult to offer that level of service as a professional HMO let, where individual room tenancies are changing.
So your whole business then is going to be involved on cutting the estate agents out and going straight to the landlords?
Straight to the landlord, because they're paying a fee anyway to a HMO letting agent. That's typically 15%, because it's more work than a single let. So that comes to us, and we take a bit more for taking on the risk of voids and bits of maintenance here and there. We factor all that in. But there's a lot of landlords that have had property a long time, or you know, they've made the money out of the property. They just can't be bothered with the hassle anymore. They don't want to invest in redecorating it or recarpeting it or even giving it a lick of paint. So from our point of view, we'll come in and we'll factor that cost in, and we'll do that work because we know we'll get more rent than the landlord thinks is achievable at property. So does that make sense?
It does make sense. I know, because I've done HMO sessions before. I've never run a HMO, and quite frankly, I wouldn't want to. It seems like an absolute nightmare. And I've seen some of the photos you've shared of what tenants have done to HMO properties.
I'll just say on the record, most of my tenants are amazing.
Most of your tenants are amazing, yeah. There's occasionally the odd one, the odd rogue bad apple.
Yes.
Yes. But when you're speaking to the landlords, I know from what I've heard others say and what I've seen myself, that letting agents try to act as a barrier between that and tell the landlords they shouldn't be speaking to people with rent to rent, because obviously they don't want to be cut out. It's in their own best interests.
Yes.
So some landlords then have been put off the idea
even before you get to them.
Yes, some. And again, that's just down to negotiation, explaining the benefits of what we offer, as opposed to...
Yes, it's an education, isn't it?
It's an education, yeah. And it's, will they get... might they get more with a traditional letting agent? Yes, if the letting agent's doing a good job and keeping their occupant... Our occupancy is probably 98% across our portfolio. You know, our occupants are really high. Our rents are top of the market. The quality of our properties is top of the market. And that's bit different to when you've got a letting agent showing somebody around a house, and they're not going to go in and wipe the worktops down before a viewing or clear out the drain while they're there, because they're not getting paid to. They're still making their commission on whatever rents do come in. So it's normally the people we tend to work with are landlords that have been in the game a little while, and now want a little bit of an easier life. They're not so fussed about trying to squeeze as much out of the property as they can. They just want to know it's been looked after, know it's been taken care of, and getting paid every month.
And your HMOs that you look after, are they all sort of in the Chester area?
No, we actually haven't got any in Chester.
Really?
We've got quite a lot on the Wirral, Wallasey, Birkenhead, and quite a few in West Manchester, Salford.
Oh, wow.
South Manchester.
Okay. Are you worried about, because obviously there's very specific laws in London.
Yeah.
Are you worried about licensing spreading out and rules changing affecting your HMO business?
No, the HMO industry is already pretty heavily regulated and licensed. You know, we've got licenses for all our properties. Everything's fire checked, gas safety checks, electrical checks, alarm checks, lighting checks, PAT tests. All that's done annually.
Checked. So that the whole HMO industry then is developed and established enough that something couldn't come in and completely throw a spanner in the works, has just happened with serviced accommodation.
Never say never with this government. No, I think it solves a... There's a massive demand for people of all ages now, more than anything, that are looking for somewhere nice to live that's affordable And, you know, when I say professional HMOs, it's easy for you to think, okay, well, we're talking about some guys and girls straight out of university, 23, 24 years old, that need a place to live while they look for their own one-bed flat to rent or two-bed flat. And that's not really the case. We've got people in our HMOs, our longest tenant's been with us since our third property, so that must be 12 years now he's been with us. We've got five or six tenants that have been with us 6, 7, 8 years. And they're paying, those guys are probably paying a little bit below market, current market rents. But if you're paying, let's say, £600 a month for a room and it's got an ensuite, and that's your only outgoings, that's quite appealing. You think, oh, why wouldn't you buy, you can rent a one bed flat for £600 a month. Well, in certain areas you can. But by the time you put your council tax, your gas, electricity, phone, broadband, put all your bills on top of that, that's one person paying out £1,000, £1,100, £1,200 a month. It becomes quite a financial drain. Back to the point that it's easy to think it's the young 20-year-olds getting started in life that are looking for HMO rooms. We get more and more inquiries from people in their 50s, 60s and 70s really? Looking for rooms at the moment, which is a sad state of affairs, in my opinion. That, but for the same reason, they're looking for whatever change in circumstances, looking for somewhere affordable for a period of time that just they can move into quickly and just get back on top of their finances.
So out of all the properties that you're managing then, the HMOs and the buy-to-lets, how many people do you know the number that you're actually giving homes to?
Probably mid-90s.
Really?
Yeah. Got 72 in the HMO rooms.
So when you started this, was your intention to give 90-odd people, bordering on 100 people, homes?
Yeah, it was to a certain extent, yeah. Once I made the decision, can we get into property full-time, what do I have to do? It was, and it, we had to make a decision then on what type of property, you know, what standard of stuff, of product do we want to put into the marketplace, because there is still some absolute tripe out there.
Shysters,
that's probably the word.
Rogue landlords.
There is, but then there's also, there's a market at the lower end of the demographic. Make sure I say this the right way. There's various demographics of a tenant and affordability, and there's a market for that. You know, there's plenty of tenants that don't want to pay more than £400 a month and just want a room and a bed to sleep in, and they'll put up with all the shit that comes along with the other housemates in that environment. And then there'll be other people that will pay double that for a nice ensuite room with some bougie warp. Ruben uses that word all the time.
Bougie.
Don't really know what it means. Bougie wallpaper, you know, and, you know, almost sort of boutique kind of living in a HMO environment. So there's that whole raft of options and demand at each level.
So you've got the HMOs.
Yeah.
You've got the buy-to-lets.
Yeah.
But of course, that's not enough for you. You need to have more property strategies as well that you're doing.
Yeah. So we've got some service accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is where you are, similar model. So we initially got into the HMOs on this rent-to-rent, this guaranteed rent basis, and then over the past few years, we started buying again our own HMOs. Serviced accommodation, we got into on a similar model where you're leasing properties and you're renting it out through Airbnb and Booking.com, for example, on a nightly rate. So we built quite a big business. I say big business, we had 12 properties pre-COVID. In and around the Chester area, mainly focusing on the sort of touristy holiday leisure.
So people leisure coming market. For shopping, coming for the races.
Like yeah, that. There's a huge stable, relatively stable tourism business in Chester. You know, you've got the Roman Wars, you've got the races, you've got Chester, a number of people that come for Cheshire Oaks. But there's loads of reasons to come to Chester. So we built this business again from a cash flow point of view. It was a natural evolution from we're doing all this. We know how to find the properties, we know what works, we know how to negotiate them, put the right contracts in place. We built that up to, I say, 12 properties pre-COVID, and then the world just shut down, didn't it? And
some shit happened. Yeah,
something happened, and I think we kind of at that point of COVID, we made a decision we wanted to get back to, because the leasing stuff's great, but you don't own the asset at the end of the day, right? So it was really easy to go, let's grow a little bit and you put some marketing out, or you go and view some properties and negotiate on them, and you can add them into your portfolio quite quickly. You know, you're not buying, so you're not waiting 6 months to go through conveyancing. You're just negotiating a deal, and normally we get the keys in a couple of weeks. So it's really quickly to really good to add cash flow to the business quickly when we wanted to. But you're kind of on the back foot a little bit when you can be negotiating, and you come to the end of a three-year contract. The landlord's quite often thinking, well, source it up now. It's all
you could do marketing. This myself.
I could do this myself. Or if it was a tired HMO you took on, it's all been painted now, isn't it? And it's got nice new carpets in it, and it's only a few years old. We'll take it back. So you're on the back foot a little bit negotiating. Not all landlords, because landlords tend to fall into one or two categories, in my opinion. They want to manage it and be on top of it and get the most out of it, or they really don't care as long as somebody drops in their bank account every month. Which is strange when they spend hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of assets. And I think we've got one landlord. I don't know if you'd be watching this, I doubt it, but I think we've spoken to three times in 13 years.
Really?
Yeah.
And he just gets paid every month?
Paid every month. He doesn't get asked for anything. Doesn't get, you know. How's the new kitchen, new bathrooms in?
Presumably.
The money he gets paid has changed over the 13 years. Or is he still getting paid the same now he was 13 years ago?
Not significantly.
Really?
Yeah. But again, they just getting paid. They're
off. Oh, you've got a cracking deal there, haven't you? But you better hope he's not watching this.
Their motivation's different. You know, they're not worried about the property anymore. They know it's going up in value. They know there's an asset there. What they don't want quite often sometimes is to rock the boat and go, well, we're not paying more, so have it back and now work out what you've got to do with it. So, but quite often you are on the back foot from a negotiating point of view. Not all landlords are like that.
But the thing is, with serviced accommodation, it's a lot more hands-on work than even a HMO, which I imagine is a pain in the ass.
HMOs aren't that bad. They've got this real bad rap.
I guess I'm just not a people person.
If they're managed well. So we did a deal in the summer where we've basically agreed to buy a portfolio of HMOs. We're actually buying the business they're set up in. And we've got we've got an option to buy their company at an agreed price. We buy the assets.
So does the business own the properties, or are the properties in a separate business again?
Their business owns the properties. So we've got an option to buy their business and the assets in that company.
That's not a recommended setup, is it? For the business operating the HMOs to also own the properties.
I'm not a tax advisor, but...
Well, I mean, if something were to go wrong with it, say somebody were to die of negligence within one of the properties, and that business also owns the property's at risk. Whereas if it's a separate company owns the properties are ring-fenced, they're safe. So if you were to do something dodgy, which I know you wouldn't, but if it did happen, then if the business owns the properties, they're at risk.
I don't know. We're not buying their their management company. So they bought these properties. They refurbed all these HMOs and they put this in these HMOs in this portfolio in this business, and then they give them to somebody to manage, and they've done an absolute shit show of a job. Half the tenants weren't paying. Half the rooms were empty. Those that were in were paying half of what market rent was. There was no guarantors, no deposits, none of the right paperwork was served. It was an absolute shit show.
Sounds like a letting agent I had in Newport.
These guys were so desperate to have that problem and headache solved. And they approached us about a guaranteed rent, and we ended up negotiating an option to buy that company. So we had to step in, and we had to give all these shit tenants new contracts, new paperwork, and almost swallow the fact that most of them weren't going to pay for the first few months before we could evict them, but to be able to legally get them out. And they're all, most of them are gone now. So it's back in August. Most of them are gone. The ones that are still there are great. And we've refilled it. So we've solved that problem. So that was a headache. But most of our tenants don't cause any problems whatsoever. Yes, there's a bit more maintenance, but it's having the right team in place of people you can call. So once it's set up right, HMOs aren't as bad as people make out. Service accommodation, you're right, is a lot more work though, in terms of jumping through hoops to keep people happy.
Yeah. So do you still have the service accommodation now?
Yeah, we've got four, five units. They're all bigger properties that will sleep 8 to 10 people. We do a lot with the contractors during the week, and then we'll do leisure guests on the weekend. So the properties are big enough to, for a couple of families or family and grandparents to go and stay in all in one go, rather than two bed flats and one bed. So there's so much competition out on the market at the moment, which is a lot of people struggling, I think.
And a lot of properties you're not allowed to do it in.
Yes, not a lot of flats and head leases. And
yeah, people do.
Yeah.
Does that irk you?
No. That's what, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. What?
I've never talked politics on here, but I think I need to.
Brilliant. Yeah. What have warned me?
Yeah. Sorry. No. Nothing specific. Well, yeah, it is. What's your thought, right? As I understand it, for the people we've got in the UK, which is a big population, many of them can't afford to buy their own home. Without private landlords, there wouldn't be enough housing for the population. So why are the landlords being consistently punished by the government at every possible opportunity?
You know the answer to this, don't you? It's, in my opinion, it's simply vote winning. It's an easy headline. It's an easy vote winner to pick on the ultra wealthy Rolls Royce driving landlords that we all are.
Which we all are. We all are. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm getting my drivers pick me up in a minute.
Yeah. I'm using the helipad on the roof.
Are you? Right, yeah, okay. Yeah. It's an easy vote winner, in my opinion. And what they're not doing is they're not solving the housing problem. And I think the problem in this country is the fact that people come in for a 4-year term in charge. Right. And no one even voted this government in, did they? They come in for a 4-year term, so they make some promises that will win them votes, and then halfway through that, already thinking, can we get re-elected? So there's no vote long term plan to solve anything. The whole introduction of Section 24 that Jeremy Osborne brought in, where as a landlord, madness, we can't offset all our interest and expenses to operate our portfolio and our business. So we actually pay tax on income that we never ever receive, which is
because it's not income.
Because it's not income. It's not physically in my account, but I pay tax on it, which is insane. No other industry like that I'm aware of. And they've literally just bought, so that came in what's it, 2016, he announced that, and it's been phased. 2016, 2017. That's been phased in.
Yeah, it's phased in over
and all
years.
That's doing is all the landlords who would quite happily have gone, well, market rent 600, but they're paying 500, they're great tenants. It doesn't matter, they can stay. You know, I'd rather not
have the maths add up.
Yeah, we make a bit of money, we cover the cost, the asset's taking care of itself, we're not out of pocket. But now all the tax bills are dropping in, they're going, well, actually, I made no money.
Yeah.
And then they get maintenance bills for replacement windows and new boilers that cost thousands of pounds, and there's no money there to pay for it. So they're going, well, and we've had a big rental sort of increase recently coming out of COVID. They're going, well, actually, market rent for that property that was 600 is now 850. Well, a tenant paying 500, it needs to be at market rent, because that's £4,500 a year I'm leaving on the table that will pay for the new boiler, pay for the new windows. It's not that we want to take that money and just burn money with it. Yeah. And that's starting to come home. So all that's doing is landlords are kind of going, well, I've got to treat this like a business. HMRC and the government want us to treat it like a business. So all that's going to do is landlords go, well, I'm sorry if you can't afford more than £500 a month, but market rent says it should be 850. That's what I've got to charge. And if you have to move out or give up something to be able to afford that, there's no point in us losing the roof over your head. So you still lose the roof over your head. It's an easy vote winner. And they've rather than, we need to be building way more houses in this country. And the government needs to be building houses. And they need to be encouraging private investors and developers to be building more houses to make the process quicker and easier. And I'm not saying we should be building on every bit of greenfield, greenbelt land we can find, but there need to be, the whole planning process is a mess. That needs to be cleared up and sped up. But rather than solve that problem with the
because that doesn't win votes.
No. Well, let's make it easier for wealthy landlords and investors to make more money. Yeah, who's going to vote for that policy? So So what they did, and rather than remove Section 24 on landlords and go, well, actually, it's not really working, it's having the opposite effect. It's always been known as the tenant tax. Every landlord in the country said this will just be a tenant tax. It'll be passed on because it'll have to be. Well, now they see, and they introduced it in Ireland in, is it 2011, I think? Don't quote me on that. And rents just absolutely skyrocketed. I think they doubled over a couple of years. And then they reversed it, and then rents never come back down again.
Oh, they reversed it, did they?
Yeah, they reversed it in Ireland. And this was all put forward to the government.
I didn't know that.
It didn't work in Ireland, so why are we about to trial it in this country? So rather than reverse what's now effectively not working, they've just introduced it on serviced accommodation. And so same now, your mortgage and finance payments.
The cost of the tax, your interest on mortgage and finance payments
on your holiday let or second home or accommodation that you're renting out to contractors that are in the area working. So that margin is now going to be squeezed massively. But you're probably still making more money on that property than you were as a single let.
Yeah.
So while you're not necessarily going to go, well, I'll put it back to a buy-to-let property and someone can live it as a home, because
there's
no benefit.
You can't do that, no, because you can't afford it.
No. Yeah. So you're going to leave it as service accommodation, but they can spin that as it'll force second homeowners to put more properties back into the market for first-time buyers.
Which is bollocks.
Yeah. But that's a much better vote winner than going, we're going to reintroduce the common sense tax approach that we used to have for landlords.
As I understand it, that tax on the service accommodation, that's only if you own it in an individual name, isn't it? Not if you've got it through a business.
Yeah, if you own it in a limited company, then... And it's the same for buy-to-lets, if you own buy-to-lets in a limited company.
Then you've got different tax issues.
Yes. But the problem was, until he introduced that, nobody put stuff in a limited company because it made more sense not to.
Yeah.
There's nobody in this government... Oh, it's country really in a position of what you might call power. It's got a long enough term plan that they're implementing. It's just, okay, what wins votes? Let's demonise the landlords. But people are selling up, rents are going up, and every landlord that sells up pushes rents up higher for everybody else.
Yeah.
And there's just not enough houses anyway, so.
And yet, if you go into any Facebook group, go on to... and see the comment section of any post, you'll see it's the landlords that are the bastards. They're the ones that are increasing the rents.
Yeah.
They're the ones that... there was one arsehole who was insisting that it should be illegal for landlords to rent a property out for more than the mortgage payment.
Right. So who takes care of everything else?
Yeah.
When they phone with their broken boiler and...
Yeah,
leaky gutters they can't be bothered to clean. And
so if my mortgage payment is £1,000 a month, I should rent the property out for £1,000 a month, pay tax on the £1,000 a month that I'm not getting, and then take care of everything else, including the insurance.
Well, yes.
Yeah. Why would I do it?
There's been rumours.
Why would anyone do it?
There's rumours of Labour wanting to give tenants the right to buy their property off their landlord. Madness.
Is this... Communist China. No, well, this is this country. This you took.
I don't know. We're probably getting quite deep into the politics a little bit. Or
fuck, you know.
But yeah,
right. So you mentioned they should be developing and building more houses.
Yeah,
that's what you're doing.
Yes, we're looking to. Yeah, we're converting. The last few years we've been looking for stuff that we can convert and we can create more units or more properties to bring to the marketplace. Because there's a demand for it, like I've said. So we're actively looking for sites that we can buy and develop, and just small sites, two or three units, those sort of garden plots or infill plots that are in already urban sort of urban areas. That's what we're looking to do, because there's, again, back to the previous conversation, all the margins have been squeezed out of being like, I've got no interest in going and buying another two or three bed terraced house because there's zero money in it.
But if anyone listening to this has land,
yes,
they're not using, if they have a property they live on with a large piece of land around it,
they'd love to have a conversation,
because you could buy that land off them and develop it into a beautiful home with lovely neighbours.
Yes, and there's plenty of creative ways we can structure it so they can benefit as well. Which is what I love. That's what I love about property. And, when you kind of said earlier, you're property. I love that whole looking at a situation, looking at a plot of land or a group of buildings or a property or someone's situation, going, well, how can we structure this? How can we create something that works for everyone involved? So
is there any property strategy you wouldn't touch?
I haven't been lured into the old social housing, which seems to be a big strategy at the moment. Everyone's jumping on the social housing bandwagon again because the government aren't solving those problems themselves. They're passing it into the private sector. So there's a lot of people that are leasing stuff onto housing associations on a guaranteed rent scheme. Doesn't really appeal to me. I want to be in control of what I do.
Sounds like even more work.
Yeah, I think it's the unknown of everyone. So we make arrangements and agreements, promises to landlords we work with of what condition the property to be kept in, and they'll be handed back in. I would quite happily show any landlords any of our properties right now without even going in and be confident of the condition they're in. I think my concern is you give something to a social housing provider that are dealing with different, again, spectrums of demographics of the population is what condition that property comes back to in 7 years of wear and tear, and you've got to spend $25,000 refurbing it.
Yeah,
but it just doesn't really appeal to me, to be honest.
No,
maybe I need to go and learn something. Maybe there's something I don't know. Which
I know. There's courses in it.
Yeah,
I've seen the talk. I saw the talk when it was first debuted, and it didn't appeal to me. Didn't appeal to me. There was so many ifs, whats, and maybes about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, look, there's, if anyone's listening to this and they're thinking about getting into property, there are so many different ways of doing it, so many different strategies you can use, so many different levels you can do stuff at. You know, you can make millions and millions of pounds building a massive, massive buy-to-let portfolio if you want. You can do it right at the bottom end of the market and have a HMO portfolio in that demographic and make loads of money if you want to deal with all the shit that comes with it.
Yeah.
Alternatively, you can go and buy penthouse apartments in London and really good money if you've got the capital to get you started. You know, so
if you've got the capital, yeah.
There's loads of different ways of doing it. It's just working out. If you do want to get involved in property and build me, I'm a big fan of multiple streams of income. That's what I love about it. You've got to find out what you want to do and what interests you and what drives you and to what level you want to do it. And there's plenty of ways of doing it.
And I imagine one of the best ways to find out the different strategies that you can do is with your networking group.
Yeah, that's one of the ways for sure.
Yeah.
Yes, we set up our networking group 2019, 5 years ago in May.
It's been that long.
5 years ago in May. Just reminding me, I promised everyone cake. But we set that up to bring together people locally that I knew were doing stuff. We were driving to Manchester, to Liverpool to go networking, and I knew there was people locally. I just wanted to bring people together to, whether you're new and looking at, you know, do I get into buy-to-let, or what's all this service accommodation and Airbnb I keep hearing about, or should I buy an HMO? A lot of new people coming along to learn a little bit, but then we've got experienced people in the room doing multi-million pound commercial conversions and running big HMO portfolios and service accommodation business. And then all the professions and trades you need to get to know to be able to deliver that service. So it's just a bit of a melting pot of bringing people together, really. Made some great friends out of it as well, which is a nice little side benefit.
Yeah, I imagine the trades that you meet will be very useful in the work that you're doing on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing to sort of deliver a decent service. Yeah, whether it's HMOs or service accommodation, it's having people you can rely on to fit you in and do a good job. Sure.
And for people listening, when is it?
It is the second Monday of every month in Chester, the Keeper Property Meet. So if you're within an hour or so of Chester, South Manchester, Wirral, North Wales, Cheshire, come along, Routon Hall, and just search for some event. Right.
What made you want to do that yourself? Because there's a lot of, as you said, there's a lot of property meets around that are quite outside of the area, but there's a lot of franchises as well.
There is.
So there's what? There's PPN, there's PIN, there's... Fuck, I can't remember the others. There's loads of them.
There's loads, yeah.
There's loads of them. You could have taken one of those. But you wanted to do it yourself and brand it yourself.
Yes.
I'm just wondering
Marketing.
Marketing.
So we, I've kind of explained a little bit of my property journey. We made the decision that, you know, when we started with our own money and we built that up and we borrowed a little bit of money from friends and family, we made a decision just kind of before COVID, really, that if we want to scale and do more bigger stuff, we need to start working with other people's money. I've been really hesitant about borrowing money off people that I didn't know. I've seen a lot of people do it badly, all over social media, and you're thinking they're dog's bollocks, and then all of a sudden they're gone and you never hear from them again. So we were kind of really kind of quite cautious about doing that. Setting up our own network event kind of coincided with that, of positioning ourselves in that point of authority at the front of the room. There's a natural perception, if you're willing to stand up at the front of the room and facilitate discussion and introduce people and run a meeting, that there's a level of expertise that is or isn't there.
So it's the credibility.
It's credibility. And, it, you know, I believe I know, I'm not saying no evidence or everything in property, but I know I've got quite a lot of experience and quite a lot of knowledge. But putting ourselves at the front of the room, branding it ourselves, has definitely been really beneficial when we're out talking to prime investors and prime individuals about working with us with their capital.
And if someone's listening to this thinking, I'd like to get started in property myself, other than coming along, obviously, to your networking meeting, second Monday of every month in Chester.
That's it.
What advice would you give them?
I'd say there's loads of information out there. Grab some of the books that are out there that kind of outline the general concepts of property. Simon Zucci's Property Magic is a good place to start. There's loads of podcasts on property. There's loads of stuff on YouTube that's all free. Do you need to spend loads of money on mentorship and courses to get started in property? No, I don't think you do. But it depends on where you're coming from. If you've got capital, it's easier to go and get started. So that'd be my first recommendations. Start reading, start listening to some podcasts, watching stuff on YouTube. If you then want to go and learn more, is do it in an environment that you're happy with the decision you've made. Don't go along, because, and I say this at our event quite often, I can get any speaker up here for 45 minutes and you will leave here thinking you've got to do what they do. Yeah, you can talk about a specific strategy and you can sell all the good points, whether it's service accommodation, HMOs, commercial building, land flipping, adding value through planning.
Everyone will seem like the best
strategy. It's the best thing. People are like, I'm doing this, it's amazing. Mm. But there's always a load of crap you have to deal with and problems and challenges you have to, you know, in every strategy. But no one's going to stand at the front of the stage and sell that. So
they sell the dream.
They sell the dream. And that's the problem with the whole property and maybe the wealth creation industry, is that it's easy to sell a dream because the people are looking to better themselves, looking to get ahead in life, looking to make a change to lifestyle and circumstances. It's easy to be sold on that. But to sort of, if you are looking, is take a step back and go, well, what are my strengths? What do I enjoy? What do I need to know? I'm a big believer in education and mentoring if you're at a point where that will help you get through the next stage. Not because you went along to a free event and someone sold you for 3 hours and their NLP is great and their marketing is great and their sales spiel is great and you walk out going, I've got a 10 grand public speakers course to do next month, and you have no intention of becoming a public speaker or have a use for it at the moment. No,
I've literally done one of those.
I didn't know. No, nothing against. And I'm sure the course was awesome. Was it?
It was. Yeah.
Yeah, and you got loads and loads of value out of it.
Yeah,
and you learned a lot.
Absolutely.
And you're a better speaker.
I think so.
I hope so.
I think I talk all right.
You've done a TED talk, haven't you?
Have we not mentioned a TED talk? I have. It's a TEDx talk. Sadly, not a TED talk yet.
But for you, that course was at the right point of. Yeah. Right, there's skills for what you're doing with the podcast and your speaking and training. I can learn more in that area to make me better at what I do. That's great. It's not great for Janet, who's a single mum at home, who's looking to add an extra couple hundred quid to her monthly income.
Yeah, it's not going to do it for her.
Nothing against Janet. But, you know what I mean? At that point on the journey, this is irrelevant. But so many people get sold into doing, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, when really something else would have been a lot more suitable, and you don't need to spend.
Yeah, and there's a lot of course junkies.
There is. And every time you bump in, you see the same people on the same circuit, and you bump into them, and it's like, what are you doing now? I'm doing this now. And
so, well, did you do the other stuff? It's like, no, we actually do that yet.
No. So, well, yeah, I mean, it's you feel for them.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I coach and mentor people, so, but it's commit. No one places any value on free. I'll agree with that concept. You know, I've given free books to people and stuff, and, you know, saying they want to make a change and doesn't have the same impact. But at the same time, you don't need to spend thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds to start taking action, because signing up to a mentorship or a mastermind for 15 grand, 20 grand that you put on a credit card that you haven't physically got that money, you haven't got the cash flow to pay it off, hoping it's going to change your life, it won't, just because you paid the money. You've got to be ready to take the action and do all the work that comes with it.
I know. I paid David Lloyd every month for months. Never went, and it didn't do me any good.
No.
No.
It's the same sort of thing. You've got to be willing to. And I think the thing I found from a lot of the course, and it's not necessarily always the information on the course. It's the environment you put yourself in with, the people that are around you, and the conversations you have, networking. And maybe a bit of the accountability that really makes a difference. And if you're ready to implement the stuff they're talking about, you get loads and loads and loads of value out of it. But if you've just been, oh, that's a nice idea, there's my credit card, they're the ones that don't take any action.
As a final point,
yeah.
If someone's listening to this and thinking, I want to find out more about Kiba Property Meet, or I want to find out more about your development, or anything that you're doing, how you can help them, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
The best way is probably to look. We're pretty active on Facebook. That's probably our main social media platform. Have a search for Kiba Property, K-I-E-B-A.
Kiba Property, or myself, Kieran Toner. I'll pop up. Connect with me on there.
Kiba Property Meet, if you want to come along, if you're local to Chester. I am on other stuff, LinkedIn and Instagram. But
that's mostly snowboarding, I suspect.
Mostly snowboarding.
Mostly snowboarding. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Kieran.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
It's been enlightening.
Good.
It's been enlightening. And a political rant as well. I like it.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for inviting me on.
My pleasure. Thank you.